Begin to record.
Okay. Good morning and good afternoon, and thank you everyone for joining us for this really fascinating session, RERIS session with Francois Doppler-Speranza, who's presenting on two of my favorite topics, public diplomacy and kind of how public diplomacy and sports diplomacy intersect vis-a-vis the basketball terrain. The primary work that we'll be focused on today is his recent book, Une armée des diplomates, les militaires américains et la France, 1944 to 1967, which came out last year, as well as a recent journal article that picks apart a little bit more succinctly, teases out the issue of basketball diplomacy, when talking about Europe gets more game every day, professional basketball, transatlantic sports models, and European integration since the 1950s, which really does an interesting job advancing certain key arguments that are found within Une armée des diplomates. So without further ado, Francois, I will turn the floor over to you.
All right. Thank you so much, Lindsay. Thank you, Philippe, for the invitation. What brings me today is the result of nearly 10 years spent devoting my time to two issues, intercultural contacts between French civilians and US soldiers, and the role of basketball as an official and unofficial conveyor belt of US culture to and from Europe. So the book I'm presenting today, as Lindsay said, is entitled An Army of Diplomats, the US Military in France, 1944-1967, published in French with Strasbourg University Press. It offers some insight into a recent episode, namely the journey of US culture in France alongside soldiers, so the SAMEs during the Great War, or GIs in and after the Second World War. The Army produced a number of photographs and films, brochures, and newspapers that were distributed during the two wars. However, the work of State Department officials who were, in perfect US tradition, allegedly reluctant to promote the armed forces is much less known. But opportunity sometimes makes a thief. US Foreign Service officials seized the chance to create myth and disseminate images whose liveliness was matched only by the controversies that erupted, particularly in France, where this new culture upset a well-established literary and intellectual avant-garde, as well as a quite provincial public opinion. So this book does not focus on war per se, neither hot or cold, but on the effects of war on culture and identity. This process reveals a new diplomatic practice that crowns efforts to militarize information and culture in the United States. As French journalist Claude Julien wrote in 1968, the US government's cultural centers abroad are hardly less important than its military bases. Placed at the forefront of the US strategy, military bases in France were for at least 23 years part of the development of a nation of outposts or a pointillist empire, as Brooke Blauer or Daniel Immerwahr discussed. But culture is neither static nor innocent, and the post-1945 US public diplomacy raises three questions. First, what was the strategy adopted to promote the military presence in France? How did it differ from traditional diplomatic practices? And finally, who were the cultural intermediaries, men and women, invested with this mission? My main argument is that the transformation of traditional uses of diplomatic practice led in only a few years to a policy that a French observer of the time called parabellicist, that is to say, aiming at keeping US public opinion on a war footing. So could culture help he who wants peace prepare for war? A real paradox for a country where there is no ministry dedicated to cultural affairs. This paradox is the starting point of my book, composed of four chapters that revolve around this idea of a parabellicist strategy of the US public diplomacy. It shows what led diplomats and military officers to overcome their incompatibility in character and tell the story of how these practices altered French-US interpersonal relations from the World War to the Cold War. So this talk will be divided into three parts in true and correct French fashion. First, I'll explain where military bases fit in the US public diplomacy network. Then I'll discuss the role of basketball in the militarization of the latter network. And finally, I'll look at basketball's change in direction in the Cold War. Philippe, if you could possibly go to the next slide. Here we go. Thank you. So first, the book discusses how the much debated public diplomacy effort fits within the framework of this anthropological approach to US military bases abroad. According to Herbert Gaines, as is on the slide here, culture is generally considered a form of spiritual expression. It is assumed to be above concerns as material as politics. But this idea of culture remains naive. Policymaking involves the distribution of resources, power, and prestige in society, and culture helps to adjust this distribution. End of quote. So culture helps with the organizing of the power and prestige of the US abroad, but advocates of a planned approach to cultural affairs would get bogged down in the long-lasting ideological trench warfare over federal support for the arts. World War II legitimized a consensus toward the use of culture and information to ensure national security. That's the reason why I start in 1944. Interestingly, US bases abroad exposed two sides. First, a civilian side. Scholars identified the main areas of activity, pushing the US foreign policy agenda, strengthening people's exchanges, running an official cultural diplomacy, and developing the media, radio, and television influence. So in sum, public diplomacy achieves the making of a predominantly American public sphere of influence. There's also a military side. To Lieutenant Colonel Walter Sweeney, author of a treatise on military intelligence and information methods back in 1924, war is a phase of international relations. Therefore, to ensure domestic security, the US in time of peace must be prepared to transform itself at any time into a state of war. End of quote. So in short, on its military side, public diplomacy meets the demands of national security by bringing the military presence into the public sphere. In both cases, public diplomacy uses war and peace to shape public opinion in a very top-down bureaucratic way. In 1949, writer Jacques Ayoncourt published an article entitled Americans, Information, War, and Peace, in which he chronicles a very dense, capable, and adjustable American public opinion, very ideological and focused on local politics. He said, "It's over-the-top patriotism for fear of looking suspicious shows how pacifist by nature and on principle Americans can be. As a result, its government happens to support, at least not discourage, press campaigns that can be described as parabellicist. Also, we must not let the nation fall asleep. The government demands that in peacetime, the country remains on a war footing." So this is where I got this idea of naming that parabellicist strategies, but Ayoncourt ignores the relationship between civilian and military authorities, which to me is the crux of the public diplomacy equation during the Cold War. Sport is a good example of how parabellicism manifests itself in the case of interpersonal activities during events organized both on and around military bases in France. I believe it added to the power struggle between military and civilian public diplomacy offices, redefined the traditional bureaucratic approach taken by the practitioners of public diplomacy, and potentially altered sporting practices. As we see on the map here, so this map is a description of the 1950s, the military bases in the 1950s in France with all the air depots, army bases, NATO bases, which were all different things. But the construction of US military facilities in provincial France led to a significant influx of servicemen. By 1958, close to 100,000 of them were stationed across the country in the framework of NATO. Meanwhile, the military affairs advisors of the US Embassy in Paris designed a specific program promoting Western alliance against communism, a common heritage, economic democracy, and European integration. These were four themes that were designed by the US Embassy. Geared toward the promotion of Western capitalism, this program, whose aim was to bring credit to the contested military presence in France, stands at the crossroads of a state-funded policy and a network of local partners, thus supporting the hypothesis of structural homology and explaining why US military bases were continually placed on the edge of traditional public diplomacy programs. Philippe, if you could move on to the next slide, please. So in keeping with its assumed bias of a bottom-up approach, the book presents a few case studies written into the Parabellus' strategy narrative. As we'll see, basketball is one of them. Thanks to its popularity and intrinsic moral qualities, basketball offers a framework to understand US and French national identities, alongside a question about the use of sports for diplomatic purposes. Cage teams formed on military bases everywhere in a competitive spirit, or to keep boredom at bay. At the same time, it endured well-known tensions. The general hostility toward Americans in France arguably stemmed from the end of a period of innocence. André Siegfried, or Georges Duhamel's inner war accounts of the modern life in the US, had now become part of the French reality, lending itself to satire, as in Jacques Tati's movie The Big Day, for example, or causing resentment from those who perceived US modernity as a poison chalice. And as we see on those two pictures, the French Communist Party was actively working on swaying public opinion in every shape or form. And just a quick comment on the map on the left, it's striking how accurate it is today, how this map has been sort of reused since the beginning of 2022 and the invasion of Ukraine. I will not comment on the one on the right, but it's how the French expressed their discontent, I feel. Philippe, if you could move on to the next one. Thank you. So in order to talk about basketball and Parabellus' strategy, I'd like to discuss the Desert Rats of Chambolet, established in 1955, one of many examples of US Air Force basketball teams created in Europe. This case study is briefly discussed in the book. It helps to illustrate the Parabellus' strategy of what is known as diplomats in short pants, as Sports Illustrated stated in the 1950s. A more in-depth version of this case study appeared in the book Beyond Boycott that Nicola, Gregory, and Phil edited a few years back. I believe it is a stepping stone for a wider debate on the use of sports to enhance one's cultural heritage and establish a form of symbolic domination, which I will discuss later with the case of transatlantic sports models. So briefly, the team was organized at the initiative of a colonel with players who enlisted instead of playing collegiate basketball for financial and strategic reasons related to a military conscription in the late 40s, early 50s. There was also a member of the Harlem Globetrotters on the team. A pretty good team, in fact, so much so that Chambly Air Base was put in charge of organizing the first GI basketball All-Star game in 1956, a fine promotional tool for the base. Thanks to basketball, Chambly became a new side of diplomacy, allowing for a spectacle of the other, in the words of Stuart Hall. In post-war France, basketball was played by many, already fully legitimized and nationalized. It presented all the characteristics of an embryonic movement of sports diplomacy at a time when there was no such thing as a celebrity diplomat. I'd like to underline three steps showing how the Desert Rats were promoted in order to reveal the Parabellus' strategy used by military and civilian public diplomacy authorities. Philippe, please. First step. The creation of a brand image to pushing US foreign policy. 1956 was rich in sporting events. In addition to the Air Base Championship and the GI All-Star Game, the Rats were invited to showcase their talents against a local team during the 1956 Armed Forces Day. On this occasion, the European Command issued a booklet entitled An American in France, distributed in town halls, churches, schools, sports clubs, and music schools around each military facility in France. It was produced with the assistance of both civilian and military public diplomacy offices and discussed the political, economic, and cultural impact of the US military in France. The page that I'm projecting here is particularly informative, dedicated to recreational activities for GIs. Indeed, there is no reference to basketball or baseball whatsoever, even though that day this is what they played. Instead, it showcases soccer in order to build bridges between US soldiers and French citizens in an attempt to standardize social codes, aiming to create joint and consensual national security positions. Philippe, please, thank you. Second step, a break in binary opposition. In order to settle a lasting GI presence in the day-to-day lives of the French, the military high command spread the message that servicemen were stationed in France only to ensure the safety of the population. The official base paper organized the dissemination of a political image of basketball players in French. An open base event offered aerial display and military parades, followed by a basketball game between the Rats and a local club. The type of basketball played by the Rats projected an image of American modernity, advocating for a flowing playing style based on fast breaks and few dribbles, as if the spectators were to side with either the ancients or the moderns. On that matter, the base paper wrote, Oboué, so the local team, was formed in 1945 and was largely able to perfect its technique thanks to the exchanges with US Army teams stationed in the area after the liberation. The sports helped the US public diplomacy walk the fine line between war and peace, manifesting an example of the heritage of Western civilization. Philippe, thank you. Third step, a need to tailor the message to the audience. In addition to all the festivities, the US High Command received local municipal officials. They discussed adjustments needed to improve the conditions of the US military in France. French officials were therefore the target of a strategic communication effort. But more interesting is the way in which basketball evolved in the US public diplomacy strategy. Indeed, the next day, the Rats played an exhibition game against the Syracuse Nationals, then NBA champions. After traveling across Africa and Europe on substantial funds allocated by the State Department, the Nationals ended their tour in Chambly. On the picture here, we see on the one on the left, we see the tip-off with the then star of the Nationals, Adolphe Chaise. Let's look at the spectators on the right. All of them are well-dressed. On the left-hand side, a colonel is having a conversation with the queen of Chambly, who came at the request of the town mayor. According to a veteran of the Rats that I got to interview and that I'm still in touch with, the woman in white is the winner of another local beauty pageant. Spectators are all part of a select group of the wealthy local bourgeoisie or high-ranking military officials. This game helps build a socially homogenous community on and around the base. It is also worth noting that the radio station American Forces Network traveled to Chambly alongside the military newspaper Stars and Stripes. AFN offered several reruns on the air and several articles appeared in many base papers distributed in France. The aim is therefore, on the one hand, to use basketball to place the American audience isolated from the outside world on a war footing. On the other hand, the military high command uses basketball to work behind the scenes with local officials and influence their decisions. So this well-executed strategy shows the extent to which the U.S. armed forces monitored all relations with local populations and rests on a particularly imperial conception of a network of bases perceived as enclaves of U.S. culture. But as the parabellus strategy suggests, sports were part of an outward-oriented diplomatic process, but also followed an inward movement, allowing for the transformation of U.S. culture from abroad. Such imperial entanglements operated from the margins, informally making monitoring almost impossible. And as we'll see, European authorities also understood the power of basketball to influence their populations. So finally, as a third part, I'd like to give an example of how basketball diplomacy went rogue. This is how I perceive this evolution so far. It's still a work in progress, I have to say, but here it goes. It was reappraised from the mid-1950s onward, from a then well-oiled American official machine to a tool to counter the growing influence of U.S. basketball in Europe during the Cold War. So this will give me the opportunity to briefly outline the evolution of my interest in U.S. public diplomacy in the final years of the military presence in France that I briefly discuss in the book. And I will present a reassessment of Hoop's diplomacy's potential to support European integration, as is discussed in this journal article. In the 60s, the U.S. State and Defense Departments had seen the proof for themselves. Sports were an efficient tool to power projection abroad. Contrary to the previous decade, many French people played basketball with U.S. servicemen or dependents on military bases that were previously isolated from the rest of the country. Children were targeted, and the publicity around intercultural sporting activities took a different course. For example, the U.S. Air Force praised the serious efforts that had been made to form soccer teams among school children. Although soccer is only played exceptionally in the U.S., a deputy commander wrote in a secret memo, the military sought to establish closer contacts between the French and the American and asked students to learn about this game, which is popular in France, to serve the interests of military families. End of quote. Children became informal ambassadors, even though the school children on the other side of the Atlantic were quite disappointed to find that their goodwill did not pay back, he also commented. PE teachers also set up volleyball, basketball, and handball games, and every Thursday, young French children took a bus chartered by the U.S. Air Force to go play sports on a base. This weekly escapade had tremendous promotional effects. For example, a brochure entitled NATO in France, as is projected here, shows young people playing European soccer in an urban environment outside the base. The caption reads, "French soccer is very different from US football, but the young Americans quickly adapt to it in the company of their little city friends with whom they play." Cultural influence through sports seemed in every way reciprocal. Yes, thank you. More importantly, the evolution from domestic protection to power projection may be ponder the effects of the growing interdependence and interconnectedness triggered by such informal sporting interactions in Europe. So why Europe? Because European integration is one of the themes designed by the State Department in its 1954 memorandum. I also noticed that at the exact same moment, European basketball launched a transnational bottom-up effort supporting the return to a less overt, yet constant, anti-American sentiment. Indeed, FIBA, so the International Basketball Federation, set up a European Champions Cup with 16 national teams in 1957. By doing so, it adapted the practices of US public diplomacy, often mislabeled Americanization, to shape European identity through basketball, not yet fully labeled Europeanization. So in other words, basketball matured into a sporting corollary to the Treaty of Rome, signed a few months earlier. The European Champions Cup had two unstated objectives: to support the continental economic exchanges to push it back against any form of U.S. domination. I'm saying U.S., but it was not stated, but it's clearly the U.S. that is targeted, and then to guarantee peace through continental prosperity. So I started working on this issue in the framework of a Jean Monnet chair in sport history and sociology. My goal is to assess where the U.S. fits in Europe's potential hoops diplomacy. So everyone thinks about the dream team in the 90s NBA, but this was only an epiphenomenon, I believe. Basketball fits Mary Nolan's transatlantic century rationale, since it definitely contributed to the symbolic, political, and social construction of Europe. In 1957, five national representatives of FIBA met with General Secretary R. William Jones. In its monthly bulletin, the French Basketball Federation welcomed, as is here on the left, the good start made by the organizers of the first European Cup, set to take place in 1958. Inspired by US public diplomacy practices they'd been exposed to for over a decade, sports leaders seized the chance to make basketball a conveyor belt for the European ideal. At that time, political rapprochement was perceived favorably, since Germany's economic recovery was slowing European integration down. Leaders of Basketball National Federation were convinced by the idea of forming a borderless territory, an idea shared by the transnational political elites across the continent. So basketball provided valuable assistance to bolster continental economic exchanges in the face of foreign economic presence in Europe, so the US, obviously, and maintain peace through the ideal of continental prosperity. The popularity of basketball across the European continent stemmed from its appeal to the European middle class in France, but also elsewhere. It was very popular in parishes, in educational circles, notably for its power to attract young people and convey values advocated by their organizations. Basketball provided a bridge between institutions and contributed to the Europeanization of citizens. But it soon led to a confrontation between what Gérard Bossuet described as an illusory US zone of influence and the reality of the European community. Therefore, the opposition to the symbolic domination of the US started to be questioned at a moment when US basketball domination over international basketball started a relative decline. Resistance developed with the process of Europeanization as a counterpoint. For the US, nothing really went according to plan, especially after the Soviet Union won the Olympic tournament in the Munich Games in 1972. At home, the Games were henceforth considered, as David Large said, a political forum for anti-US sentiment. The 1976 Olympic Games in Montreal saw the rise of Yugoslavia, opening a new chapter in international basketball, only to be put to the test by the dislocation of the territories of Central and Eastern Europe at the end of the 1980s. Indeed, the geography of European basketball changed dramatically, destabilized by civil wars and the breakup of some states after the Cold War. For example, the Serbo-Croatian War led to the exodus of a large number of elite players who, after playing in and for the USSR, joined the Italian, Spanish, and Greek leagues, as we see here on the slide. At the same time, some of them were selected in the NBA lottery and turned their backs on Europe. Vlade Divac with the Lakers and Drazen Petrovic with the Trailblazers, but also Dino Raja with the Celtics, were only a few of them. The war had also an influence on their style of play, as the press showed about Raja, who was strongly affected. The Sporting News said in 1994, playing basketball and playing it hard and well can be such a wonderful diversion. These precursors conveyed a specific image of European basketball, tough, determined, different from the more modern, dynamic, aerial style in vogue in the US. Overall, the European basketball diaspora reinforced an imagined community a symbolic dimension that reflected in the organization in Europe. However, the development of professionalization at the beginning of the 1980s quickly called into question the European basketball model. Indeed, the professionalization of European sport accompanied the last years of the Cold War, culminating with the creation of the Union of European Basketball Leagues, ULEB, in 1991. Obviously, it was meant to replicate the NBA model. The stronger focus on professional basketball led to the emergence of of European sports entrepreneurs, whose job was to promote European values through basketball, often informally. So, this time around, ambassadors for short pants instead of in short pants. Key to the development of the identity of a sport, basketball, and of a political entity, Europe, it became a complex diplomatic tool in the decades following the Cold War. In 1999, a private company was formed to promote the interests of Europe's most powerful multi-sport club under the name EuroLeague Commercial Assets. This brand created a confusion in the classification of European basketball competitions, so much so that two parallel competitions were organized in the 2000-2001 season, so EuroLeague and FIBA Super League. This conflict, which we detail in the article, is yet to find a solution. So even if it's odd when you think about the initial objective of Europeanization, which aimed to counter the growing influence of US basketball in Europe, the totemic appeal of the US model of basketball helped negotiate and reassess the identity of European basketball. In that sense, hoops diplomacy as conceived in the US in the 50s really went rogue. So to conclude, I tried to show how basketball fits in the parabellus strategy of the US in the framework of military bases, especially on and around Chambly Air Force Base. The use of basketball for diplomatic purposes was initially determined by the creation. You can actually leave go back, Philippe. Yes, you can stay on this one. Yes, thank you. So the use of basketball for diplomatic purposes was initially determined by the creation of a network that responded to both domestic and foreign policy imperatives, considering that US bases were seen as enclaves of US territory abroad, or Little Americas, as they were also called. So four preliminary conclusions emerge. Originally, parabellicism was exclusively used for domestic purposes, but would later show its potential in pursuing internationalist foreign policy goals, especially regarding NATO. On this matter, Ayoncourt wrote that it finds sufficient justification only through direct and constant threat, which he thinks pertains to all opponents of US capitalism. Then, parabellicist campaigns allowed to bridge the gap between military and civilian claims of power in promoting the US Army as a whole. This aspect is developed in the first two chapters of An Army of Diplomats. Also, parabellicism potentiates an ambivalence in the dissemination of information used to propagandize and collect intelligence, and the infamous American way of life to boost army morale and display an irresistible modernity. This aspect is developed in the last two chapters of the book. Finally, parabellicism opened the door to a reciprocity of the process with Europe that has expanded since the end of the Cold War. The globalization process of the NBA shows the fundamental importance of European players to win athletic victories, but also the necessity to attract spectators, European spectators, thereby immersed in US capitalist culture, as well as a strong commitment to liberal internationalism, avoiding Joseph Nye's fear of a continental drift, as he stated in 2000. This season's race, and I'm talking about 2022, this season's race for MVP title shows the extent to which basketball is but just one way to fashion an Atlantic Europe, rather than a continental one, through a reassessment of modern-day liberal internationalism. The recent creation of the Basketball Africa League that Linza works so brilliantly on supports a similar idea and perspectives. So today I presented the example of basketball, but there are several cultural elements in the book: music, education, literature. But I always felt that basketball remained the best possible example since, as we saw, it has increasingly become part of the European cultural identity and European way of life, put in question today, actually. It highlighted the ability of citizens to experience Europe directly without having to resort to intermediaries, institutions, or governments. Therefore, sports entrepreneurs of Europe are a new type of public diplomats, largely inspired by US methods, in particular by the bottom-up approach. Thank you.